Thank you, sir. And Mr.
Revere, as the court is well aware.
You care to reserve any rebuttal time, sir?
No. 2 minutes.
Yes, sir, 2 minutes. Thank you.
We're here, as the court is well aware, to consider that conundrum of words and scintillant evidence that is of great interest to us as lawyers, and I assume judges. The public in general has no interest in whatsoever because they've never heard the word before. But I would urge that the defendant has everything to live or die, or to be free or not be free, based on that word. And so that is a part of the essence of this case. Is there enough evidence to offer the instructions that we traditionally call Cascadian instructions?
Well, in this case, wasn't the defense that was being asserted was self-defense?
It was self-defense, but that does not mean that we had to go with what we had, so to speak.
Oh, yes.
So had we had the Cascadian instruction, then we would have the opportunity then to argue and further say, and let the jury know. I think that's the important thing. It's very important that the jury know what the options are, what the law is. The jury doesn't know these things except from what we tell them, and if the judge, in deference to the judge, if the judge doesn't say, you know, this is a case that you can consider all of the options. And it went, the jury in fact went from aggravated malicious wounding down to malicious wounding, which was the only two options they had.
Right. Maybe this question is better asked of Ms. Darren, but do I gather correctly that there's no issue with regard to whether the proposed instructions were correct statements of the law? The only issue is whether there's any evidence in the record that would justify giving them.
That is the unlawful wounding
and the assault and battery.
My knowledge, I think they're correct that I offered them. Okay. And so I believe.
Yeah, I assume they came from the model instructions or something.
They came right out of the book. I think off the disc, to be honest with you. But in any case, what happens in this case is that there are really five verdicts that could come in this particular situation. You could have aggravated, you could have malicious, you could have unlawful, you could have assault and battery, you could find not guilty. Unfortunately, the jury was not given the option of looking at the facts of the case to make the determination whether or not this was a case in which there was malice or not malice.
And even though we analyze this from the perspective of the light most favorable to the proponent of the instruction, and even though all it takes is slightly more than a scintilla to be entitled to the instruction, there needs to be something to support that instruction. Otherwise, we're going to generate confusion among the jury. And if the case is defended on the basis of self-defense, the bottom two on that cascading instruction just don't fit, do they?
Well, they do, because had the jury known that the question of malice was in play, so to speak, that is, was there malice or not malice? Was this an incident that arose from either heat of passion or from circumstances that arose immediately among the confrontation between the two of them, or in this case, the fact. And I think it's been discounted a lot here, but the fact that this lady had a knife, the man was cut. He was cut in the hand and bleeding. His shirt was torn, cut in two places, and the t-shirt underneath it was cut. The knife was found in the doorway to the lady's room, which is the way that she said that she left after this happened. The police officer, who was now retired, is accused of taking a gun and pointing at her, in her words, at her head, firing, but somehow that she got struck in the chest area here. I would assert that a police officer with 25 years experience, if he had the intent to kill or maim, that he would have done better than that. She says, in her testimony, there's a great conflict in these cases. I'm sure the court has seen this, but there's a conflict. She says, he took the gun and took it out of the room with him and had it with him when I went into the bedroom. He says, as soon as this happened, I threw the gun on the foot of the bed and chased after her to see if I could attend to it. The gun was found, right where he said he left it. The knife was found in the doorway. Knife, and by the way, blade pointing out as you go into the room. There are plenty of things we could have argued to the jury to negate the question of malice had we had the opportunity. But once the judge takes away the opportunity for me or any defense lawyer to tell the jury, to argue the entirety of the case to the jury, they are left with only two choices. Aggravated malicious wounding, third choice, of course, is
will. Are there places in the record that you can point us to that would suggest that this was that there was evidence to suggest that this was an accidental shooting?
Well, and of course that is getting to the case of came down in April of the King case that this court had in Bonk in April of this year, and was right in the middle of the process of appealing this case. And of course that could be interpreted as applying only to accidental cases, but I think the broader interpretation of that case was given in one of the concurring opinions.
Right.
That
you're looking at two of the judges
involved.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Just look at all of them.
Yeah. Except we're on opposite sides of that particular point.
By my question, I did not mean to suggest that you're limited to accidental. I'm talking about the context of this particular case. That would be one of the options that you would have. Is there anything in the record to support?
I don't think there's anything to show that it was accidental. So I think there's plenty in the record to show that this was a heated and ongoing domestic problem that ended up in an unfortunate shooting. Two different versions. The jury could say this was done without malice. There was no question that the lady was shot. There was no question that the defendant shot her. That's not the issue. The issue, did he have the sufficient and only intent that would come from the question of malice? And there was plenty of evidence in there had we had the opportunity to be able to show, well.
Don't you have a situation that when you have self-defense involved, reaction to that, that because there are a couple times where reasonableness and whether you've acted properly in response and all like that are involved, that you can have the situation where if you use too much force to really be entitled to self-defense, you can have the situation where it doesn't excuse everything, but it can switch it from not being malice or somewhat of akin to whether there is actual passion, but you switch over and the issue becomes more, was there actual fear or was the response too great? And therefore, while you don't get a complete excuse or justification that you get from self-defense, you do get a negation of malice as opposed to the lesser offense. Usually this comes up in the murder cases, but you have the same stair-step effect. Can't you get that where the application, you really overreacted, or you really weren't that entitled to be that scared or something like that? That does put the malice, unlawful issue into effect, which I guess is foreclosed if you don't get the stair step.
And the answer to that, of course, is yes. That's the very point that circumstance. If the jury can't look, if you can't argue and talk about the totality of the circumstances, We know that this jury gave the minimum on every one of those charges, but they didn't have any choice. And in this case, this gentleman, the difference between a unlawful wounding conviction and a malicious wounding is 10 years. 10 years in prison because the mandatory minimums that are applied. You take the malice out of the picture, then there was no use of a firearm that could have been used in the case, and no mandatory on the unlawful. So the jury would have had a whole larger, broader ability to make a just decision in this case had we had the opportunity to bring that before them. I simply say, and again, in deference to the trial judge, but basically what happens is that the trial judge can foreclose the possibility of looking to alternates to the circumstances. And I think that's a really big, important thing, is that we as jurists and as lawyers, we have to try to seek justice by giving the broadest and most open opportunity for the totality of the facts to be considered by a jury who are just lay people who try to do what their best. That's in essence where we are in this case. That's how I see it, and I would urge the court to consider this in light of the King case and other cases that are cited at plenty in there. And this issue of Scintilla, I'm embarrassed to say that I have looked in the opinion of the initial unpublished thing, and I see a case that I had 37 years ago in the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court, that was on an issue of Scintilla of evidence. What goes around comes around.
Seems like we ought to get it resolved sometime soon. Huh?
Thank you,
sir. Ms. Darren, and thank you, Ms. Darren, while you're making your way to the podium for being here today. Understand that we're able to go forward today because you're covering for your colleague who's celebrating her nuptials.
Yes.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Kiernan will, from henceforth, will be Elizabeth Fitzgerald. And she is on her honeymoon. And so I am here on her behalf in this case. And I would like to point out, just at the threshold, that certainly a tactical decision could be made by counsel in a case such as this, that they would want the jury to be put in a situation where they would have to find malicious wounding or find the defendant not guilty.
All or nothing.
Exactly.
Well, Ms. Darren, let me interrupt you. I should have put this question to you, I think. It's the same one I asked your opponent. The Commonwealth doesn't take any issue with the proffered instructions insofar as whether they're correct statements of the law regarding assault and battery or unlawful wounding. Does it?
This instruction A on page 17, I think, is the cascading instruction that is in the model jury instructions. But what is not in here is what exactly unlawful wounding is, and that instruction was not those instructions that were would be needed were not proffered.
Well, typically the way it works, at least in my experience, is where you have the lesser, it's a lesser included instruction of malicious wounding. You know the lesser included on unlawful goes something like. And if instructed the jury, if you find that the Commonwealth has proved each of the elements of the offense with the exception of malice, then you shall find the defendant guilty of. But malice is separately defined as a separate instruction, typically.
Yes, it is.
But I just am trying to simplify this argument. We're really only focusing on whether there is enough evidence to warrant an instruction, not whether the instructions proffered had any defects in terms of their.
Yes, that's right. So, and our point is that. It could have been an all-or-nothing theory of defense.
Well, it could have been. Let me follow up on a question Judge Bumgarner asked your opponent, if I can. defense here was self-defense, but I mean, hypothetically or theoretically, I guess is a better way to phrase it. Theoretically, you could have an asserted self-defense, which was an imperfect self. In other words, maybe you had a duty to retreat, and the jury doesn't find you retreated. That, to the extent that whatever facts were presented, while they might not amount to the affirmative defense, if a jury could theoretically find that they negate one or more elements of the offense charge, wouldn't an instruction be warranted under those circumstances?
If the defense had argued, if there had been some evidence to support that, if there had been some theory advanced by the defendant or the evidence, and that's simply lacking in this case.
Well, let me cite to the defendant's testimony, and I'm not sure I have the page number exactly, but it's around 209, I think, in the joint appendix. The defendant testified, quote, "I didn't aim or I didn't know where to hit. I just wanted to scare her and get her away from me so I could get out of the apartment," close
yes.
quotes. Now, just taking that statement standing alone. Now, of course, a jury doesn't have to accept it, obviously.
Right.
The trial court clearly didn't accept it, obviously. But the trial court wasn't the fact finder, the jury was. And so if that statement is in the record, which it seems to be, why wouldn't that standing alone support a lesser included instruction of both unlawful wounding and assault and battery, since if believed, it would seem to negate both the elements of malice and the element of specific intent?
Well, you know, I point to 291, where the defendant says he shot to scare her. But this comes with his testimony that he, at the same time that he at page 313 he grabs his gun and he shoots in self defense. At no point in the case is accident or heat of passion. Heat of passion is only mentioned in defense counsel's brief on page 10.
I'm not sure, maybe I'm not making myself clear. I understand the law to be, maybe you disagree, but I understand the law to be that when you have a jury in the box, the jury's entitled to be properly instructed on all matters of law that relate to either the prosecution or the defense theories of the case. And so, as long as there's evidence, some evidence in the record to support it, and the jury then decides whether to believe that evidence or not, and if they don't believe it, they don't need to apply the applicable law. If they do believe it, then they should. It seems to me, if that statement is in the record, and it negates elements of offenses that are charged but might support lesser included offenses, that standing alone would be enough to warrant giving an instruction, whether that was the primary defense or not. In other words, it's not. Is it up to the legal argument? In other words, if a defendant asks for an instruction, isn't the law, as long as there's more than a scintilla of evidence in the record to support that instruction, they're supposed to get it? Isn't that basically what the law is?
I would simply answer that question by saying, where in the record does the defendant point to evidence supporting the
I just read to you the statement, the, state, the testimony.
Where does he?
You're saying he has to argue specifically. It's not enough just to ask for the instruction. You've got to say.
Where's the scintilla of evidence to support it? And we don't.
And you don't think
that
that's it?
Well, he certainly didn't argue that. His theory of the defense.
So you have to argue. It's not enough just that it be there and you ask for the instruction. You're saying you have to make an affirmative argument.
There has to be a scintilla of evidence, and again,
is it a scintilla of evidence or a scintilla of argument that you have to have?
It's a scintilla of evidence, and our position is that the evidence in this case that he didn't ask for, his theory of the case was self-defense. It was an all-or-nothing defense, and when he comes to the end of his of the case and he asks for the instruction, there's no evidence regarding why the instruction's appropriate. And the judge rejects it. I'm looking at, touching on what Judge Baumgartner mentioned earlier, you know, an unlawful wounding instruction would be appropriate where, and again, a lot of this law comes from murder cases. So you have to insert unlawful wounding for manslaughter, for example.
Let me ask you this: had the attorney for the defendant at trial cited that passage that I just read? And I'll read it again. I didn't aim. I didn't know where to hit. I just wanted to scare her and get her away from me so I could get out of the apartment. Period. Close quotes. If the defendant's attorney had cited to that in the record and said, "Your Honor, based on that, we want an instruction on unlawful wounding and we want an instruction on unlawful battery," would that have been enough under your analysis to warrant giving it?
It could have been. Yes, it could have been. But again, he didn't direct the court to that evidence, and his theory of defense was all or nothing.
But insofar as the theory of defense is reflected in the closing argument,
yes.
By that time, the horse has left the barn. The jury instructions have been argued, and they're already decided, and so counsel is limited to
yes.
what he's going to argue then, because he needs to work with what he's been given, the hand
yes,
he's been
yes.
given.
Yes, that could be, but I'm looking at 74 and 75 of the appendix, okay. which is the opening argument, and that's where they lay out the theory of the case, and it's a straight case of no malice, self-defense.
Well, I've been around a long time, and I tell you, if what's that expression? Judge Bumgarner probably knows it better than me, that no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. And I don't think I've ever tried a case where what I said in opening statement was exactly the way it played out by the time we got to closing
and
argument.
And I understand that too, Your Honor, but I don't think that the defendant gets the cascading instruction in its entirety just because it's set out that way in the.
So it's, just so because the evidence would support it and you asked for it, that's not enough, is the Commonwealth
well,
position.
Our position is under the circumstances of this case that the evidence didn't support it, that the defendant. The bottom line is that the evidence didn't support it, and the judge did not err by refusing that instruction A on page 17. Are there any further questions? We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Sweezy, referring to, and this is from Joint Appendix 291 is close to Judge Humphreys was reading from. I just wanted to scare her is the point. He just fired to scare her. It still is an intentional firing, right? I mean, does that?
The gun didn't drop to the floor.
Right, right.
That is a fact, but the circumstances described was that he was being cut by a knife.
Okay.
And so that gives a little bit more justification for trying to scare her away. I do want to speak to that thing of we did not argue the point of scintilla of evidence. Of course, 90% of what happens in the jury in the judge's chambers when instructions are argued are not on record.
Which is a problem, which is
something you kind of remedy. I can't come to you and tell you something that happened that's not fair, that's not on the record, but I can
tell you that it hurts you vehemently,
but that's all I can say to that. The point is this, I think, here we are arguing about was this, or wasn't this, could this be, that's the point. Here we are, that's the point, where are you? The jury didn't get that chance. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel, and that completes the docket.